actually related to that, so.
It's not even off topic. And I, oh, projector. Okay, there we go. So, first off, what I wanted to show you is, well, I've been a little finally getting some stuff done here. So first off, assignment one is up. The only thing that isn't finalized, I just wanted to kind of make sure there weren't any like really stupid wording issues with the questions. Otherwise, it's 13 questions, 20 points. I'd like to still have it due for in a week because we're sitting here on the 24th. This is the 31st. This is all stuff we've been talking about in class almost. So, if you work on it and you talk to me next Wednesday, you go like, I'll have it due on midnight on a week from today. And if you come into class, you go like, I need a little bit more time. It's like, I'll go, okay. But, yeah. Oh, sorry. Oh, thank you. Who is going to take notes for today? Come on, people. This is why does no one want to take notes? That doesn't make sense. I mean, this is a great way to show that you're. Okay, thank you. Please, talk to Neil afterwards. Cool. Okay, so I am perfect. If you.
You say like midnight is it right when it turns January 31st, or like the night of January?
So 11:55 p.m. on January 31st. You're right. Midnight is ambiguous. So that's what it's. Again, this is all stuff. These all I'm thinking shouldn't be that hard if you've been keeping up with the class. On the experiences side, now I have at least a few of them. One of them you've already completed, the common tools one. That was like, okay, that's definitely experience. That's a gimme, you know. But these are all a little more, I wrote the replacement password program a little more elaborately. I'm going to add a section at the top talking about grading for these things. But if you do something on an experience where it seems like a reasonable amount of effort and you kind of done things, basically the default grade is going to be 3 out of 4, which basically gives a 75%, which is a B. So if you kind of make a reasonable effort stuff, expect a 3. If you want a 4 out of 4, you need, you know, that's 100%, that's A+. That means you actually did something a bit more extra. Like you're trying to do some of the optional things, or you're really trying to, go deeper into it. I mean, I expect for most of you, like a 3-level performance is probably a couple hours work maybe. But to get up to a 4, potentially take, a good bit more, maybe double that. So, because again, it's like those of you who get into it, and you put a lot of effort in, then I want to reward you saying, okay, now you're on the course for an A+. But if you just got to kind of like, okay, I'm just going to do something, it's like, okay. That's and in particular, I'm not interested in you all doing things that you already know how to do perfectly. If it's something that, oh, I already know how to do this completely, it's like, because I spent, couple of years being a sysadmin, and this was my main job, and so here I'm doing this. Is like your write-up will reflect that, because you can't write that from a perspective of learning. You can write it from a perspective of knowing it. So I'm going to give a variety of these things throughout the term, and you should be. And if you think of things that you would like to learn in terms of security, like, oh, that's a tool I don't know, or I know there's this research area I would like to study or something. It's like, okay, I'm fine. I think maybe we should make a separate channel for ideas, so as opposed to general getting all overwhelmed. This is an opportunity for you to push yourself, but I'm not really interested in those of you who know a lot just showing off what you know. I want you to, just none of you know everything, because no one does. I could easily sit here and come up with 10 experiences that would be very challenging for me. And it wouldn't even be that hard. So, I've been doing this for a long time. So, do something that pushes you a bit. I'm not saying spend crazy amounts of time, but, try to do something. And for those of you who are, feel like you aren't so experienced with a lot of these things, this is your chance to get some experience to figure things out. So the write-up is really about the journey you took in trying to learn about this area. And the grade is really proportional, like, you know, how far into the journey did you go? You'll get one regrade over the semester because the TA's times are limited. But one time you turn in something and you get like, if you get a 3, we're not regrading it. Okay, you're fine. But if you get a 2 or 1 or 0, you know, for something, you can redo that once. Because I figure one time is enough for you to kind of learn what our, you know, expectations are and kind of figure out what it is. But after that, you know, I'm giving you flexibility with when you turn this in. You know, I'm kind of saying, I'm setting up deadlines basically every week or so for you to turn things in because, well, really, you should be staying on top of things if you can get this many done. But if you push them off later, okay. But, you know, in exchange for that flexibility, though, I mean, we're going to grade it.
So the submission should be sort of journal-like, right? That's what you want? Like, I've never done this before. This is what I kind of want to get out of this. This is what I tried. This is what worked. This is what didn't work.
Exactly. Okay. And, I mean, you know, make it, I prefer more of a, think of it as telling us the story, your journey of doing this. Like, okay, I want to, you know, set UID root binary capabilities. Okay, so I'm looking at these programs. Like, I never really knew what this program does. I did these experiments, and I tried this, and I saw this is what it did. And then I took away the set UID bit, and all of a sudden it blew up. My machine, you know, formatted itself. Or, you know, and I didn't understand this, so I did this experiment. You know, it's like, there's a mindset that you have when you're trying to understand things. And if you're going to do anything in security, most of your time spent doing things in security is figuring out what the heck you're doing. Because you're dealing with problems you don't completely understand, tools that are poorly documented and do weird things. I mean, it's just, everything is a struggle. And so if you just, I mean, if I packaged up something, this is the, if I packaged up something nice, it's like, just do this little thing. It's like, no, that's not what the experience is. That's nothing like what the experience is.
Two questions. So if you're submitting something that has code, like
please include the code.
Include the code and like your logs, your experience with the code. And let's say you did 9 experiences and you got a 0 in one of them. Mm-hmm. Would a redo count as doing a separate, like a different experience, a 10th one, to override that grid?
So when I say I do a redo, it means that you want to replace one with, you know, like you got a grade on one of them that was too low and you want to replace it. So you could either try redoing that one or you could do something completely different. But honestly, I don't see, unless the only reason I could see for doing something different instead of just trying to extend the work you did is just because you really hated what you were doing. You just didn't want to learn it. It was just, you know, offensive. I mean, it's, yeah, it's like right now my girls are having a little issue with math. And so we thought, oh, let's do this online system, online test thing, right? Where it's like this service where you do the math problems on like an iPad and then someone talks to you, there's this coach and stuff. It's kind of cool. It's like instead of going to a class, you kind of do that online. Both of my daughters, there were tears after the initial evaluation. They just, because they were like, I couldn't go back and correct my mistakes. I couldn't, they just freaked out. It's like, failure is an option. You're going to fail. You're going to come across and go like, wow, that really didn't work. And if you're not failing when doing these experiences, you're doing something wrong. Because this stuff is, like, messed up. Like, I, you know, here's one I just thought of. How many of you have heard of Kerberos? Okay. Set up a Kerberos domain. You'll find. Now, of course, one way to do this would be to set up a Microsoft Windows Active Directory domain, which actually uses Kerberos underneath it. But then, and that might actually work initially, but then try adding a Linux client to it. You'll experience pain. Have any of you done that?
Almost.
I said not to.
Okay. But I mean, it's like, I'm not even saying you necessarily get things to work. It's like you sit there and try doing it and try all these things, and no, it just doesn't work. I remember one time I was trying to get NFS working with encryption. Okay, NFS working by itself is easy peasy. Getting NFS working with an authenticated encrypted link, that was painful. If you want to go out and do that, that, you know, things like that. I mean, just trying to get things work in an actual secure way as opposed to just getting it working is often a whole order of magnitude more complexity than just getting the thing working. And why that is worth thinking about. And I have ideas, I don't have a fixed answer, but it's a fact. So this is playtime. This is for you to get your hands dirty. What makes sense for each of you depends upon your skill level. I will be posting ideas that are definitely related to this, but the tests are fundamentally based on the assignments. Because I'm not expecting you to do a common set of these experiences. But if you do not take time and do these sort of things, your depth of knowledge of this material will not be the same. Because there are common things that you will have to deal with in trying to do anything real in security. And it's more than anything how you look at the material. And it will change how you look at the questions that are being asked. I'm not going to just give you exactly the same questions on the test as I give you on the assignment. I'm going to say it's going to be based on them, but it's going to be the concept behind them. And I'm going to expect you to kind of step up a couple of levels, not just see, oh yeah, there's this bit, it does this. Why is that bit there? What kind of mechanism is it? What other mechanisms are kind of like it? You know, it's, why do we need these kind of things? How do they fail? Why do we still use them? That's the kind of perspective I want you to have on these things, because only then do you really understand the material. I mean, this is not a systems administration course, although there's definitely, you know, some bits of that in here. It's about security. Questions? I should really plug in my laptop. That might help with the screen going down. I did plug in my laptop. Okay. Never mind. No. Okay, so now I'm going to stay on my computer, because what I want to show you is, let's play with virtual machines a bit and talk about virtual machines and security and such. So first let's get, I'm not making my font big because I don't. So first off, I made a little virtual machine. Yay, yay, yay. It's just, come on. There we go. Boot it. So this is Ubuntu 17.10, 17.10.1 server. And that's gonna be my reference platform for this class. Not to say you can't play with other things. You can even do a lot of stuff with Windows. It's just if I'm asking for very specific Unix-y questions, I'll be talking about this because there can be some variation in other platforms. You're welcome to do things in Arch or something, or Gentoo or anything else. But there should be a lot of things in common, but I have to pick something. So this VM I am making available to you. I need to add the link. So I'm going to add a link to this, but if you see this, there's a .ova. This is a, what's it called? It's an interchange format for virtual machines. So you can import this into VirtualBox, because this was generated by VirtualBox. You can also import this, I think, into VMware. You might end up in some issues with disk image formats, and it might want you to translate it or something.
If you have, if you really want to do that and you have trouble, let me know. But VirtualBox is open source, so although we have a site license for VMware, so you can download that. You can get that's how I built this. That's what this image is right here. Is just that. So in this, I have an account. Let's see if I can. Let me make this bigger. Scale mode. Okay, that's not what I wanted. Watch, does that let me stretch the window? Yeah, it does. Oh, okay, good. Okay, that is what I wanted. So we now have. Now there's, you might go like, well, I want a GUI. You're welcome to install a GUI in your VM and do that, and you can install Ubuntu 17.10 desktop. I haven't customized this VM at this point at all. The only thing that is there, it's an account called student. You all know the password for the student account, right? TNEDUTS exclamation point, or student backwards with an exclamation point. So, virtual machine running on my computer. First question. How can I SSH into this virtual machine? And why is that a not so simple question?
Networking.
So you have a machine here, and it's running on your machine, so I have access to it. So if I put an SSH daemon on it, why can't I SSH to it? Well, it all depends on the kind of networking that has been set up. And you might go, well, why can't this just be easy? Security. When you look at something, why can't that be easier? Generally, the answer is security. Which is depressing, but true. So let me be specific. You go over here, and you go to settings, and you look at these network adapt, you look at the network here, and you see here, and it has this list of options. And you're going like, what are these? Why are there so many options? And so when you learn security, you end up learning about just about every other technology in computer science, because they all touch on it, and they all touch on it in annoying ways. So first off, what's NAT? What does NAT stand for?
Network Address Translation.
Network Address Translation. In other words, we don't have enough IPv4 addresses, so we must share. So this is the technology that's used at your home, because almost all of you have, if you have a home network, you only get one IP address from your ISP. And that IP address is given to the box that connects the internet. So like your cable modem, or your DSL modem, or whatever, has an IP address. Everyone else has to share. So what network address translation is every other box in your network gets a private IP address. If you see any IP address that starts with 10, or starts with 192.168, those are designated private IP addresses. They are not for they're not globally routable. The rest of the internet kind of goes like, what the hell are those addresses? They don't know about them. They are meant for internal networks, and they have to be translated to something else. So that's what the box on the edge of your network does, is it translates, it basically impersonates all the other boxes. It rewrites packets as they go by. So if you're coming from 10.0.0.4 on your box inside the network, it then gets translated at your router to whatever address the ISP gave you, and it goes out to the world, it comes back, and then when it comes back, it goes, okay, that IP address, let's map it, 10.0.0.4, because it's coming back on the same port. That's what network address translation is all about. Now, security analysis. What does this buy you, and what does this not buy you?
All external traffic has to come through that box.
all external traffic goes to that box. Now, so I'm not saying you can, on your NAT device, which is acting as a router for your network, that box can implement firewall rules in order to restrict traffic. I'm talking about just the NAT. What does that provide?
Well, it makes it easy to spoof, right? Because there's a mechanism for...
Well, so yes and no. I mean, it's certainly rewriting the packets. But it's having to keep track of the connections and stuff. So, I mean, it's related to that.
Any incoming connection will be going to whatever device you have NAT running on. So if you don't set up some sort of rule to forward a certain port to some other place, NAT won't know what to do with it. So it'll either accept it in a local machine or most of the time just drop.
Right, exactly. So what this means is if you're surfing the web, you open a connection to a remote machine. So on that open, your router can then keep track of, you're trying to reach this machine. And then when the return packets come back, it has a record saying, that packet's meant for my laptop, and it sends it back. But if there's just a random connection from the internet that comes to your IP address of your network, it goes, I don't know who to send that to, because no one made that request. And so it just drops it. So in effect, no one on the world can see your boxes. So it does by default, even if you don't set up any firewalls, there's an implicit firewall always with a NAT system. Because any incoming traffic, unless there's a specific rule for it, ain't going past the box. The way you get around this, like if you want to, like oftentimes if you're running things like BitTorrent, so you need other systems to connect to your system, or you're running a game server of some kind, like you want to run a Minecraft server on your own machine or something, you'll have to modify the configuration of your router to allow things in. Because otherwise, how would it find your desktop? Because your desktop does not have a globally routable IP address. Only your router does. But how much security does that really buy you? I mean, under what threat model does that protect you? What other threat models does it? Are you not protected? So protection, the scenario under which you are protected is a random outside computer just trying to connect to your box. Trying to, like, remember all those things? You're running, maybe running some unprotected service, just something from random on the internet trying to get to it. They can't get to it by default. But how can they get to your internal network?
They can hitchhike on normal traffic.
Think about, so what's a great thing is you visit the web. You run web pages. When you visit a web page, you're downloading JavaScript code. Can that JavaScript code access other resources? Yes. Could it access a resource at IP address 10.0.0.7? Yes. So what prevents a web page from probing your network? Nothing. Unless you're running some sort of software in your own box trying to firewall off your network. But that's actually not a common thing. But you are downloading stuff all the time. And you're downloading programs. And those programs can run and make network connections. And so they could make network connections to any other machine on your network. Let's say... You can imagine you visit a web page and you assume a standard IP address configuration for your thing. Like most boxes are 192.168 something, or it can actually probably even maybe do a little query or something to figure it out. But it then just scans your network and looks, say, for a video camera, an IP connected video camera that's monitoring your network and just breaks into it. It sends a little packet to it to break into it. And then once it's compromised, it now is running the attacker software, and that can now start doing whatever it wants. It can make a connection outbound to its home server and says, I'm waiting your command. It says,
why don't you start sending us some video? Or why don't you just start flooding, you know, this person? I was gaming, you know, playing this guy in Overwatch, and he pissed me off, so I want to take him out. So start flooding with traffic. That's what people do. So NAT does protect you, but doesn't really. So you do, it keeps some, I mean, it restricts some, and most of the time NAT is just a pain.
Does a web page access your system resources, or only like things on your network?
A web page can request stuff from arbitrary URLs. Right? Because they include an image, they include a thing. And they can, in part of the URL, you can specify the port. So, and most things now talk web protocols. So,
you can also be perhaps running an unprotected service on your own thing, on your own machine, which can be accessed by JavaScript over a URL.
That's true too, yeah.
Which wouldn't even need any enumeration.
Remember, like cups?
Yep.
Why can't you have a localhost URL inside your web page?
Yep.
Now, there is in principle this thing that's supposed to protect you in web browsers called same origin policy, which kind of supposed to keep you from messing with too many things like that. But the trend in web technologies is to dismantle that because it makes making certain kinds of complex web applications and ad servers not so easy to build. So that's been weakened. We talk more in depth about web security. Yeah, you'll find that it's bad. But anyway, we're not talking about this virtual machine here. So first off, you have to understand that whole set of concepts to even understand what NAT is. So by default, what happens here is your virtual machine is NATed to the outside world, which means that it is sharing the IP address of your box. Now, you can be behind another NAT because you're at home, but that's Nesties. So the outside world, they can't see your box, but they can see this. So you think, okay, but by default, the configuration with the NAT here is it's strictly translating it to the outside world. Your host box can't even send a packet to the virtual machine. It's completely blocked off. It can talk to the outside world, it can't talk to your host box.
Unless you run DHCP on your virtual machine to grab an IP address from you.
No, that's a different... No, that's not with NAT. If you start doing that, very weird things, because now you'll be fighting with the DHCP server for your main box, because the outside will just think it's...
It works fine.
Yeah, that would be bad. Well, you can try it and just see what happens. So the other configurations that you're supposed to do is, so NAT network... is you still are NATed, but now let's say you have multiple virtual machines running on the box. They're all logically on the same network. But that network, basically there's a router in front of it and your host is outside of it. So again, making a connection through it is very hard unless you change the configuration of that and you do some port forwarding and stuff and it doesn't really easily support that, so you're just kind of like, eh. So that's painful as well. The host-only adapter kind of says, okay, now you're just going to have a network connection just with the host. You're not talking to the outside world at all. Generic driver? I don't know exactly what that is, except I think you have to define everything. Internal network, again, it allows multiple virtual machines to talk to each other, but there's no connection to the outside world. So like if you were studying malware that was self-propagating or something and you wanted to have like a bunch of virtual machines talking to each other, that might be good.
Just to clarify, it's different virtual machines on the same host?
The same host. Yeah, exactly. And then the bridged adapter, on the other hand, that's where the virtual machine pretends to have an Ethernet connection to the same network. So now this is where your machine can logically then get multiple IP addresses visible from the outside. You have the IP address for your host machine and the IP address for your virtual machine. And the outside world can see both boxes. So that's maximum exposure when you do bridge.
Is that like an IP or an actual...
No, what I'm saying is when it's bridged, the virtual machine will do a DHCP, well, you could use DHCP or you could, you know, stack the computer, but normally it would do a DHCP request, and that would be visible to the DHCP server on your regular network. So like, for example, if I put, if I did bridged here, my virtual machine would be able to talk to the Carlton network and would try to get an IP address from there. Well, that's what you're always doing with a virtual machine. But the outside world sees it. Yeah. The outside world can see two IP addresses. With the NAT options, the outside world only sees one box, even if you're running 20, but they all have independent connections, and it depends on whether they're each getting directly out to the outside world, or do they see an internal network where they can talk to each other. That's the NAT network versus NAT. So, yeah, you can see the reason why all these different complex things is one thing about, you know, how do you share the IP address, and the other thing is you potentially want to block outside access for generally for security reasons, because you're doing something that, you know, should be seen on the outside. So how do I configure SSH from my box to the host and allow me to access the outside world from the virtual machine?
You have two factors.
Yep. That's the answer that I found that seems like the simplest thing to do. Is you have one adapter, for, and that's why I actually have this one configured, is I have one attached to NAT, and I have one for host-only adapter. And so the idea is the SSH server, you can SSH in over the host-only adapter from the host. And then the NAT one allows the VM to connect to the outside world. Now this is all okay. Question?
Couldn't you just open a port in the NAT configuration?
How do you open a port in the NAT in VirtualBox?
Port 3000.
No, I know, but how do I open a NAT in the configuration? Do you see any configuration for the NAT? You have done it? Yeah, is it in advanced? If you go to NAT,
port forwarding.
Oh, there is port forwarding. Okay, you're right. I've tried using that and it's broken.
Oh, I've done it with Node.js before. And it's broken.
From the host?
Yeah.
So you would then forward the port from, so you would forward port 22 on the virtual machine to some local thing. So what you'd end up doing is you would SSH to local host. Mm-hmm. Like 2222 to get to the virtual machine.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's many ways. So this is not to say that, I mean, I'm really, the specific solution is kind of, it's six of one, half dozen the other. What I want to point out though is that out of the box, this isn't trivial. You actually have to have some relatively deep knowledge of network topology and how things work in order to come up with the same solution. You understand things, you can come up with multiple solutions because you can, you know, do all this sort of thing. And why is this relevant? This is virtual machines on one box. What do you think it's like configuring network topologies in the cloud? If you go onto AWS or Azure or something, or, you know, our OpenStack something, there are a number of things for configuring the network and saying what ports you open and how you do translation things, and it gets complicated very fast. I mean, there's a networking is a prereq for this class, isn't it? Yes. There's a reason why. It's because there's a lot of stuff going on with this, and it's complicated in large part because we don't want everything just talking to everything. And a lot of that is for security. Some of it's for performance, but a lot of it's for security. And it's a pain. Yes?
On a more personalized work, maybe at home, you can actually just have it get the DHCP address from the router, and then...
Well, that's where you bridge it.
Yeah, you can do that, and then you don't need the host-only adapter because you can go through your router too.
Yeah, well, it's not. If you do bridging, it's like it's another box on your network.
Yeah.
Which makes it pretty easy. But then you've added another box in your network.
Yep.
And that's another box you have to lock down.
Yep.
So I'm not saying there's, I mean, depending on what you want to do, there's different ways of doing things. I just more wanted to just, this is an issue. So you'll notice, what's the IP address of the virtual machine? 10.0.2.15. And this is part of the thing that you should test. So I can say ping. Can't access it. But if I instead go, now it turns out I have a second adapter which does not, I type Dvorak normally, and of course the VM wants a QWERTY layout, so. Sorry, sudo a DH client. So now we have another IP address, 192.168.56.101. So I can connect to it, and I can also SSH to. So good to verify your hypotheses and say yes, this is what's happening. One of the reasons why I really wanted SSH to work is just because I hate interacting with this. I mean, the console is just annoying, and then you can't cut and paste things easily. You know, I mean, it's a pain. It's much easier to interact with a virtual machine over an SSH connection. And there's definitely more to talk about for that. So there's just kind of like miscellaneous things I just wanted to make sure you knew about. How many of you are working on the replacement password program? What languages are you using?
Considering Rust.
Rust. Fun. Okay. Other ones?
Trying to do JavaScript.
What, JavaScript? Okay. So Node. Yeah. I see. Yep. And
Python.
I
was going to write it in ClojureScript. I haven't started yet, but.
In what?
ClojureScript.
ClojureScript. Okay.
Some function.
So I will tell you all that doing it in these other languages, so what's the key challenges that you run in doing it in languages that are not C?
Everything else is written in C.
Well, yeah, but these things have, APIs and things like that, but that's not so much, it's related to that, but what specifically? So one very simple thing is normally setuid does not work with scripting. If you cannot apply it to a script. You can only apply it to binaries. How do you get around that? I told this, So what you can do is you can make a little wrapper program, which you just write it in C, but it's like five lines, and all that does is do an exec VE of the script. Like make a really tiny little C program that just does an exec VE of the script, and you make that binary set UID root. Now, question, why don't you make scripts set UID root?
Modifiable.
Well, if there's any vulnerability in the scripting language, or you can also modify scripts depending on how the access is for reading and writing.
It's
implicit in anything when you have a script, if you set, make a script set UID root, what you're implicitly doing is making a non-privileged program, I mean, another program, like the entire Node runtime, or the entire Python runtime, have root privileges potentially. And what other inputs does it take? All kinds of things. I mean, if it's a binary, you know, okay, this is what the code is that we're loading. With these other things, you're loading all these this other code.
Environment variables.
Well, environment variables are always a factor, yeah. But it's more like what code are you running?
Scripting language can be monkey patched.
Mm. Monkey patched. I mean, we patched afterwards. So you have so it used to be you could set UID root, and then people had very security problems with it. And they like, we could try locking it down, or we could just say don't do this. And so they don't. It's now you don't do it. And if you do want something set UID root in a scripting language, you make a little wrapper program, which is fine. Again, it's like three lines of code. You know, do an exec v. And then you set the set, whatever privileges you want on that binary. So that's one problem. But it's worse. How are you going to drop privileges? And this is the common refrain with security. It's like, to get the functionality is one thing. If you're just going to make something that edits the password file in a scripting language, that will be much easier. But how am I going to call the routines to actually change my UID or to change my capabilities? Does your language have an API for it? Some of them may, but you have to find it. It's not the one that's going to be in the man page. It'll be something specific to your language. And if it doesn't, then you have to use the foreign function interface to try to incorporate it to your system. What's probably easier, and what probably most people do, is just don't bother. But that's the real issue. I mean, people talk about, like, why does everyone write security critical programs in C when we know C has a huge history of security problems? I mean, it's hard to make sure you iterate through a loop properly and don't have an off by one error, and the compiler barely helps you with it. I mean, and there's all kinds of security problems that come from that. I mean, how do you make secure code in C? But there's a simple problem that all the low-level OS APIs are in C. So it's really easy to use those from C. And if you go to another language, you go like, how am I going to use that? Because they're mostly optimized for writing regular user space programs. The security things are sort of left to the runtime a lot of times. So now I want to make a program that actually drops privileges. I try to sanitize it. Maybe. There's all kind of little things that you can do in C from a security perspective which you can't easily do in these other scripting languages. Like, how do you know that you've something really simple. You have the user's password in memory. How do you erase it from memory? How do you erase it? If it's in C, you have an array, it's a fixed thing, you can just overwrite those characters. JavaScript? How do you get rid of it? It's an immutable string. You put it into a string, you now, how do I override it? I mean, what you could do, you could turn them into, bytes that you then store in, what are they called? There's actually a binary array type in JavaScript.
I was just going to say bytecode.
But so put it into some actual array, encode it in there, put it there, and then override it. Really, for a password-changing program, this is not an issue because the program is going to terminate. But let's say it was something that took a passphrase or did something with cryptography. It's like, how do you do that? It's not clear. Yes?
So that C's been around so long that all of these problems have kind of been...
Well, C's been around. That's certainly part of it. But it's even more fundamental. I mean, Unix was written in C, and C was written to build Unix. The two came together. And that means that if you're not writing things in C on Unix, you're a second-class citizen. I mean, you do not have the first APIs. You are doing, you have to kind of do things the way C wants, or have some sort of interface layer. So,
well, you can use FFI with languages that actually can natively go with C.
Right, but again, it's like
pretend to be C.
You're not doing it the native way the language wants to do things. You've got this other thing. Now, in principle, you could implement a complete native implementation of whatever APIs you want. I mean, on a Unix system, the only API that really you can't change is the system call API. And C can't make system calls natively. It's actually an extension to the language, or you're embedding machine code to actually make system calls. So there's no reason why other languages can't do system calls just natively. You just implement that and then have everything else done. But the fact is there's so much other infrastructure that's there that you potentially want to use. It's the not just legacy code, it's just the installed base. Do you want to write all the helper functions needed to do all the things that the kernel would, you might want to do with the kernel? You can, you do, but I mean, it's a big challenge, and it's actually a pretty big API. And then how many people are going to use all those things? This is why we still have C. That's what, Rust, I have hope for Rust. Go is certainly a very nice language, but I haven't seen it really try to like just tackle quite the same thing. It's like it's a nice world to live in, the Go world, but it's not like, okay, I want to replace C exactly. Okay, so doing, if you like, for example, if you decide you want to play with libcap, I don't think most languages have a native interface for libcap. This is the library that enables you to set and drop capabilities for a process. So instead of saying, okay, I have been given root privileges. I now don't want to keep all of root's privileges. I don't need the ability to access devices. Why does the password program need the ability to access device files? It doesn't. So I want to drop that. The way you drop it is by changing your capability mask. You look at the man page, you see a nice documentation, you load the library, you're good to do that if you're doing that in C. How are you going to do that in another language? You have to now figure out how to interface that language. It's just these barriers are there for these stupid things. But such is life. And that's really what the point is of writing the password replacement program, is hitting your head against those things and trying to think through what the solutions are. This set UID root binaries, again, this is trying to do stuff with capabilities, but from a different perspective. Just, can you make it so that, I know some of you running Gentoo or Arch have capabilities already in your file system. So that's, you then already have a leg up for doing this. But you can try seeing what the things are, because you can actually set in certain Linux file systems the capabilities, rather than just saying set UID. So you don't get all of root's privileges, you get that. So that actually makes it easier. The program itself doesn't have to drop the capabilities. So this is the other side of it, but Ubuntu systems and Debian systems don't do this. So what would it take to do that? Restricting network access, one is just
try doing all the things we're talking about, TCP wrappers maybe, or you can even do this with a Windows box, try doing a host-based firewall, try configuring the application. How, if you install a web server on your machine, can you restrict what's where it talks to on the network versus telling the Windows firewall to restrict where it is, or maybe your third-party firewall? Does anyone know the nasty interaction between the latest like Spectre meltdown stuff and antivirus on Windows?
I heard about it.
So the issue is that if you run a third-party anti-malware suite on Windows, if it has not been updated to be compatible with the fixes Microsoft has for those things. I mean, they've had to change some low-level things, which don't affect most programs, but various AV programs use undocumented, not so used interfaces. If your AV program has not been updated to deal with the changes, you get no updates, period, for your box. It disables updates. And in fact, there is a flag that the in the registry that your AV program has to set to say, I can deal with a new interface. And until that flag is set, you aren't getting anything from Windows Update. And the reason why they did this was very legitimate. It's because if they didn't do this, you install the patches for changing things, your system becomes unstable and crashes. So that's why they implemented this. But
most
of the big ones, I think, have.
Most of the big ones. There's a couple big ones that are still messing around. Yeah. Just your typical.
I will tell you this now. I think on Windows, most anti-malware programs are not worth your time. For a very simple reason. The level of access they require to the systems is so invasive that they create their own security problems. There have been a number of vulnerabilities found in these things, and some of them have done stupid things like running an out-of-date Node.js server full of security holes on a port. I think Trend Micro got in trouble for that, and then just sort of leaving it there. And so stuff can get on there and just, because if you compromise the AV system, you have complete control of the box. So that's one thing that's bad. There's another problem, which is the Kaspersky problem. Yes. Did I talk about this already?
Kaspersky and the Russian friends?
Yeah, so running something that scans your entire disk all the time for random patterns. Good way of keeping things confidential. Not. If you're going to have scanning your thing, might as well have your scanning being done by your OS vendor, because you have to trust them anyway. If you don't trust Microsoft to do their code right, well, you're just done. Just, why are you running Windows? So you at least have to trust them. Do you trust them? And Microsoft has a vested interest in trying to keep their box locked down. And if they were found doing anything like scanning for stuff that wasn't actually malware, Microsoft would lose billions. So they're not going to do it. Or at least they're going to make sure no one finds out. So if you find out, you might wake up the next day. But, who knows? I'm going to be putting some stuff up on foundational security papers, because one of the other things is struggling through papers. So that's also a way you can get some experience stuff. Try to cater different interests. So what damage could I do to my system with these experiences? That would be very bad.
Just a side note about the experiences. The first one we did, the listings, that count as one experience?
Yes.
Oh, it actually does.
Yeah, I'm saying that's a gimme.
And it's eight others, right?
It's eight others, yes. So that's why I said there's nine.
Yeah.
One was a gimme, so you have eight.
So everyone's four on that one?
Yep. So, how could I really do major damage to my system?
If you're reading password that you actually use it on your own shadow file, and you use it on your own user, then you can't log in.
Yep. If you corrupt the password file, you won't be able to log in, and you're dead. Yes?
Chmod your root directory.
Yeah, in...
completely overwrite all access control
that you're programming. Oh, make it so you can't modify your home directory. Right. Well, actually, so related to that, so I'm saying you're supposed to look at... sudo. Oh. So sudo has a set URID root bit. So that's one of the things for you to look at. What if I take away that bit right now? What have I done to my system? I've locked myself out of sudo. I have not set a root password. I have no access to root.
Also Bitcoin.
I'm saying the only way now to get root, if I were to take away this bit on here, the only way to get root access would be to boot another environment, mount this disk, and change it back. That'd be the only way.
That's not so bad.
Huh?
That's not so bad.
It's not so bad. It's a little annoying, though. And if your disk was encrypted, you'd have to mount the encryption. But basically, you have to go in and change the file system. You can't do it from within the environment. That's the only way to fix it. How do you protect yourself against these sort of oops moments?
Images?
What do you mean, images?
Just like before you delve into something potentially dangerous, just take a snapshot of the current state.
So a lot of these things allow for snapshots, so you can roll back.
You can use a snapshotting of your file system.
Snapshotting your file system, depending on whether you're using something that will support snapshots. If you're using ButterFS, sure. but the VM supports some snapshot things. But let's assume that without that that's kind of a very powerful kind of thing, which I encourage you to do. Another thing to do is just back it up. Just keep a copy. If you made some changes to your VM, just keep a copy of it. Or like you keep the OVA file, you haven't done much, and just restore it. You know, from that, make a new VM. But how can I do something just at the command line doing things? How do I mess with things in a safe way? If I'm curious what happens when I take away set UID root bit on this, what's some simple precaution I could take?
Copy the file.
Now when you copy it though, if you do a normal CP, will you actually get exactly the same thing? So let's try this. So first off, if I just do a CP of does this help me? Not at all. The file isn't owned by root. And so it's not owned by root. And it's, this is a little too low. So let me try shrinking this here. So it's a little. Oh, what happened here? Why? They moved everything around on me. Okay, I'll just do it here. It's a little easier. That's why on my SSH. So copying it here, I'm trying to type in two different keyboard layouts. So now this sudo is useless to me. So how am I going to copy it so I get a copy that would actually work?
You could possibly use rsync to preserve all permissions and all things.
Yes, rsync or cp-a.
Ah.
So So I'm just going to become a root. So now you go and so now I have the sudo bit here. Now, of course, this is in root's directory, which is not actually where I want it. but I can move it somewhere else. So now you see I've got my sudo and sudo, they're both there. So if I now mess, I might want to do my experiments with my sudo and take away the set UID root bit and stuff and see if I can get it working rather than just messing with the actual sudo binary. So in particular, if you're playing with the one for change capability, don't change it on the actual system binary. Make a copy of it, make sure the copy works just like the old one, make sure the permissions are the same, and then mess with it. Because if you take away from some of these things, you know, you're locked out. And that's going to waste time. Don't do that. Do it. So first off, have ways of recovering. Like, you can, don't do this on your main box. Please. And then don't do this in a, and then do it in a, take basic precautions. Similarly, if you're editing the password file, don't target the main password file. Make a copy of the password file. Make it owned by root. But make a copy of the password file and then have your program try to modify it. And then once you think it's debugged, then you can try using it. But really, for the exit, you don't even have to do that. But don't directly change the password file. One thing that will help you with the password file, if you want to do things as one, does anyone know about shadow config on Ubuntu system? So normally, if you look at the standard configuration now, it used to be that accounts with passwords would have the password hash here as a second field right after the username. So this, instead of this X, you'd have the username. But now that's been moved because the password file has permissions that anyone can read it. And now instead, there's a file called shadow, which only is readable by folks in the shadow group, and only root can change it. And that is where the password hashes are. So the student password hash is here. So it's this, wow, that's a pretty long hash. Why can't I highlight? Oh, there we go. Yeah, so the hash goes from here to here. You might go like, you know, I don't really want to deal with shadow files. I would like it if it was just all in one file, like the old-fashioned thing, and let's do it that way and stuff. So what you can do is you can run shadow config off. And the hash now is put back into the password file. Same thing also, there's a group and a gshadow pair. You could have, you know, things in there. So it's the same thing, gshadow and stuff. But so oftentimes, if I want to edit the password file and I don't want to make sure I keep the password file and the shadow file in sync, I just do shadow config off and edit it and then do shadow config on. So, yep. So little tricks can make your life a little easier. How are you going to figure out what that hash is? How are you going to generate that hash?
Does the documentation tell you what hash algorithm is used? Oops.
Maybe. So let's see here. Okay, so X goes to shadow file. Ah, crypt, get entry. So nope. Get entry. pwcom?
There's an entry for one SSL.
All right, all right. Okay, open SSL password. Computes the hash of a password typed at runtime. Okay, so one. Yeah, this is, okay, this kind of looks like it. But we had a six.
I just checked Ubuntu's website. Mm-hmm. They're using SHA-512 for password hashing.
That would make sense with the length. And so I think the format is... shut up. Is, and you can check this. And actually, you can, so you have this, the dollars, number dollar, this is what tells you what the format of that, of the rest of the password is. Because if you don't have the dollar, number dollar, it's considered the old crypt one, which I think is a variant of DES, which isn't used anymore. So that's a 56-bit, algorithm. That's not particularly secure. And so there's like 1, 2, 3, 4, so and so. I guess 6 may be what SHA-512 is. So you're running. So you can compute the SHA-512 sum of it. But of course, the password hash is not just a hash of the password. If you look at, at the salting, there has to be a salt added to it. I guess the salt is in there. I think if I recall, the salt is somewhere in this. I think it may actually be like the last bit here or something. These things might be the salt. I don't know.
It's directly after the
hash.
The six and the dollar sign.
Yeah,
and then there's another dollar sign.
Oh, there is. Oh, you're right. Okay, you're right. Okay, this is the salt. That means so again, you have to generating that hash, that thing there is not just trivial. That's going to take some research to figure it all out. One of the things that's a separate part of doing this. What I suggest is a stepping stone towards it. This is why I say you might want to play with change finger or change shell, because those just edit the password file, but those values are pretty darn simple. So again, get as far as you can, see what you can figure out. Wow, we're almost out of time. I just about to start another topic, but it's like I've got 5 minutes. What other tricks can I give you here? Restricting network access. The really hard part about this is how do you know it worked? So you have to find an environment in which to do this, in which you can be very sure that you know that you have got things blocked correctly or not, and that you can make sure that it's being blocked at the place you think it is. Like, it's one thing to say, oh, my router's blocking everything, and so nothing works. It's like, are you sure? So this is why I do not recommend you do this one using virtual machines. Because it's possible to do introspection on the network links between virtual machines, but it's much more confusing. You can use Wireshark or something much more easily to just tap into the network on your actual box. And then you can say, okay, I'm going to try connecting to this resource inside my network and from this box. I can try, okay, I have one laptop, I have my phone, can my phone access it? Can my laptop access it? Generally people have at least two machines at home on their network. You can check to see which ones can still access it, and you can check to see, okay, now is it restricted at my firewall or not? Okay, one simple thing is, how can I put rules to limit myself being accessed? Get access to Reddit. Think of the thing that you probably shouldn't be spending too much time on, but you do. I'm sure you all have something like that. Try blocking it. So that's, but if you're trying to do that sort of block, you're trying to block a URL. Well, no, you're not necessarily trying to block a URL. You're trying to block a service. You need to block connections to Reddit on port, 443. That actually may be a little hard, though. Why is it hard?
Because as part of SSL, the host name, the entire, it's all included in the encrypted portion, so you can't filter as easily.
Well, you can't, but you're blocking to a machine, but what's?
DNS.
So, if you're going to do blocks based on IP addresses, how many IP addresses does Reddit have? Not so simple. Now, you can do DNS-based filtering. Play with that. It'll be interesting to see if you play with that, but we'll talk in more detail why that's not such a simple thing. DNS is a whole lecture, at least, to itself. I'll probably talk about DNS next on Monday. That's probably worth talking about in terms of the security problem there. Okay, I think we're out of time. If you have questions or want to talk to me up here, go on up. Otherwise, you have stuff to do. Good luck.